This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good morning, everyone. A load of old rubbish displaying archaeology of the modern city. Museum Victoria has an immense collection of archaeology of the modern city. The most significant assemblage is that excavated over a period of 15 years from Little Lon, a 19th century multicultural working class area in inner city Melbourne. The Little Lon assemblage, totalling almost 500,000 artefacts, came to the museum in two lots, one in 1989 after the first archaeological excavation, and the second in 2003 after the fifth and final excavation of the site. Because the archaeology comes from the modern city, and I mean sort of post-industrial site, it contains predominantly mass-produced, ordinary, generic material. Almost all the artefacts are damaged. There are literally hundreds of thousands of fragmented and at times unidentifiable pottery shards, glass fragments, bits of bone, shells, metal fragments, etc. Many of the finds came from cesspits that were filled in during the mid-1870s when the sewage systems were changing. And so the assemblage is quite literally, and here I quote the museum's education department, a load of old rubbish. Large archaeological assemblages like Little Lon present very real challenges to museums in terms of how to best manage, curate, access, research, display, and interpret them. As Guy said, I'm currently working on a three-year ARC-funded project to look at the collection management of large-scale assemblages, but from a curatorial perspective as opposed to from the sort of registration perspective. But it's the curation, display, and interpretation of this type of archaeology that I'm going to address today. Following from what Brian was just saying, as museum curators, we are obligated to interpret our collections in ways that will inspire and inform our visitors. In the post-postmodern museum world, one of the most common interpretive approaches used to inspire and inform is linking the material culture of the past to personal stories. It's hoped that these narratives will create empathy among visitors, enabling them to connect with the past. It might seem impossible to consider applying this approach to an assemblage of 500,000 objects, but that's what we've done at Museum Victoria, and I believe the same approach is possible with other large archaeological assemblages from the modern city. Because we're talking about the modern city, there is a wealth of archival material documenting people's lives, so photographs, deeds, post office directories, telephone directories, etc. If we marry trench locations with these documents, we can identify specific individuals or businesses that reside at a site. And from there, we can start to make connections between the artefacts and the people that occupied the site. It's highly unlikely that we'll ever be able to say that this object belonged to Mrs. X, but we can say that Mrs. X would have had an object similar to this or to that excavated on the site where she once lived. The archaeology that started life as rubbish becomes a signifier of the past. When Melbourne Museum first opened in 2000, there was a display of the archaeology from the Little Lon in its Australia Gallery. I don't know if anybody saw it. Stories from the city Little Lon combined archaeological material, some in drawers arranged by type, together with a recreated archaeological core and archaeological tools of trade. Audio recordings of contemporary newspaper accounts, contemporary fiction, and oral testimonies were positioned between display cabinets, and contemporary artefacts were displayed alongside archaeological artefacts to contextualise the finds. So in the images we can see here, I almost need a pointer. Atop your top right, you can see there's a tabletop display cabinet. Underneath that were drawers with a whole lot of typological arranged materials. On the far right-hand corner of that back right is the archaeological core. And actually, in those tabletops there, there was a description about the conservation process of archaeology and the actual sort of process of archaeology. You can also see we've used a lot of archival photographs, text panels with photographs in, and then we've just got cabinets sort of full of materials of type to give a sense of the finds that we uncovered. Summative evaluation found that stories from the city of Little Lon was fairly well received by visitors. They enjoyed learning about parts of Melbourne's history that were unusual, interesting and colourful. They liked seeing a rich collection of archaeological material, and they liked the combination of stories, photographs, objects, and archaeological methodology. However, evaluation identified some problems with the display. It was found that many visitors didn't understand the relationship between the archaeological objects and the story of Little Lon, and therefore missed the relevance of the story. Also, there was a desire by many of the museum's visitors for the drama and mystery of Little Lon to be presented in a suitably atmospheric or immersive design. And I'll just point out, in the top right slide again, right in the far corner there, is a walk-in, a recreated walk-in schoolyard. And it was that space within the gallery that our visitors responded to with the greatest enthusiasm. So when we were developing our new exhibition, The Melbourne Story, the decision was made to create an immersive environment in which to tell the complex story of Little Lon. The Melbourne Story opened in March last year, and in one corner of the gallery we've recreated a piece of 19th century Little Lon. The new installation includes two cottages, a laneway to the side, and an outer gallery with display cabinets, text panels, and a video presentation. These slides are pretty self-evident. So in the front here, though, the lower slide, you can see this is sort of more typologically arranged material. The cottages present two types of lived experience. One has been displayed to show extreme poverty, and this is the house of extreme poverty. I should say that the cottages all have the same layout, and they're based on historical archaeology. And so there are actually sort of two rooms, one living space and one bedroom. And the second cottage, which shows the home of a poor working-class family who lived with some material comforts, also has a small kitchen attached. Unfortunately, it's such a small kitchen that we can't actually get into it to photograph it in any meaningful way. The cottages have an adjoining backyard and outside toilets. And you can see in the toilet down below, we also have a collection object in there to give a sense of, you know, well, to get as many of our objects out, but also to show the sort of sanitary pan arrangement. The cottages are completely dressed with props, so visitors are encouraged to touch everything, sit on furniture, lay on beds, feel the roughened walls. The floors creak, the cottages smell of polish and carbolic soap, and light levels are dim. 400 artefacts, so that equates to about 0.08% of the Little Lon archaeological collection, are displayed in the cabinets on the periphery of the space and the 19th century cabinets in one of the cottages. Our selection of artefacts was informed by a well-defined curatorial rationale for the exhibit. As I've indicated, the decision to create a corner of Little Lon was determined by the findings of summative evaluation. The contents of objects, text, audio, and AV was directed by four objectives. First, to challenge the myth that Little Lon was a slum riddled with poverty, prostitution, and drug addiction. Two, to people the display with real stories, not stereotypes. Three, to create a dream space, I have read Gaynor Kavanagh, where imaginations and memories converged, encouraging empathy among our visitors for the residents of Little Lon. And four, to create an exhibit that gave context to the artefacts in terms of how they were used, not how they were found. We identified a number of themes to enable us to meet these objectives. These themes, food and eating, alcohol and drinking, childhood, work, smoking, leisure, personal hygiene, jewellery and ornamentation, and cultural diversity, were selected to illustrate daily life in 19th century Little Lon for all its residents, whether child, immigrant, family, prostitute, or business. The findings of various research projects over the years informed our understanding of each of the themes addressed and confirmed our ability to comprehensively represent the themes using artefacts from the collection. We then selected material to illustrate the themes. Our selection was not based on beauty, monetary value, or rarity, though obviously rare, valuable, and aesthetically pleasing objects were included in our selection. But when presented with examples of type where one was in obviously better condition to the rest, we frequently chose that one. I'm not going to pretend that the curatorial eye doesn't come into play in some way when you're selecting objects for an exhibition. The slides have been displayed according to identified theme. These themes are clearly articulated on labels that describe the material and place it in context culturally, socially, and politically. So I'm just giving you a sense of these are the sort of text panels we have up and some of the material that will be on display around them. The stories of five individuals representative of Little Lon's diverse population are told within the houses and laneway through audio and text panels. The five are Anne Cunningham, an Irish immigrant widow and mother of three, John Maloney, an unmarried labourer also born in Ireland, Carlo Brachi, an Italian immigrant who started life in Melbourne hawking ice cream from the streets and lanes and then went on to build himself a two-storey house and factory that thrived, Sister Esther, an English-born Anglican nun who worked for the mission to the streets and lanes, and Murray Hayes, a third-generation Australian born and raised in Little Lon in the 1920s and 30s. Anne, John, Carlo, Sister Esther and Murray were selected to complement some of the identified themes. They were also chosen because they challenged the slum myth. Four of the five were owner-occupiers. They all worked or studied in Little Lon, and they show how important familial, cultural, and religious networks were to them and how these ties kept them loyal to Little Lon. Three of these characters, John Maloney, Murray Hayes, and Sister Esther, had been presented in stories from a city little long. At that time, John Maloney was portrayed as a stereotypical Irish drunkard because of the large quantity of alcohol bottles found on the site linked to the house he occupied. However, this reading failed to take into account that the site excavated was a cesspit, so would have been filled in with rubbish from nearby houses and pubs. So we now present John as an owner-occupier and part of a large extended family that lived in the area. Close analysis of the archaeology of Little Lon, conducted by historical archaeologists and curators in the late 1990s, brought to light the personal stories. Trench locations were matched with plans, rate books and post office directories, allowing us to identify specific individuals, families and businesses. Little Lon's very poor tenants and the regular visitors to Little Lon, so those passing through on their way to work, to visit brothels or drink in pubs, cannot be identified by marrying archaeological trench data with records. But their lived experience can be told through the archaeological record, as we have done at Melbourne Museum. We've dressed one of the houses to illustrate living conditions of the very poor, and the audio of Sister Esther, which plays in this house, refers to real characters that she tended to and wrote about in her day book. The Melbourne story has been open 1 year now, and evaluation of the Little Lon exhibit has been incredibly positive. Visitors respond really well to the immersive experience. As hoped, they read the two houses as very poor and sort of aspirational. They understand the connection between archaeology and display, and they're getting the message that Little Lon was more than a slum for the hundreds of people that lived there. Though 400 objects is a tiny sample of the complete assemblage, the considered selection of artefacts has allowed us to illustrate the themes identified and thereby redress previous perceptions of Little Lon as a slum. And for those that like figures, I'll just tell you that 400 objects too is about a third of the total of objects that are actually on display in the whole Melbourne Story exhibition. What the small selection of archaeology doesn't allow us to show is the sheer quantity of material excavated, nor the physical condition of many of the artefacts. Though this is not vital to the telling of the story of 19th century Little Lon, we do recognise that some of our visitors will be interested in this information, so we describe the excavations that took place in Little Lon in a graphic panel and video presentation. So you can see the graphic panel on the right there, the red one, and then the far corner you can sort of see a black and white blur, and that's the video presentation. The success of Little Lon recreation can be credited to three factors. Firstly, the financial and intellectual support of my institution, Museum Victoria. Secondly, rigorous and ongoing research of the assemblage. Such research has enabled us to identify individuals whose stories represent the lived experience for many people in Little Lon. It also allowed us to articulate a clear curatorial rationale for the exhibition. And thirdly, the construction of a historically credible environment, enabling the artefacts to be contextualised. Little Lon, as presented at the Melbourne Story, is a creative response to displaying the archaeology of the modern city. We've used the mundane, mass-produced and broken artefacts to inspire, illuminate and inform our visitors about life in 19th century Little Lon. Thank you. Thanks, sir.
So, questions? I might kick off with one.
Go ahead.
I think the paper followed very, very well from Brian's, and I thought there was a sense which Brian's talking about enactment and how like visiting a place like the Little Lon exhibit is sort of a visceral experience, and I wondered whether that was perhaps what Brian was thinking and perhaps what you think as well.
Well, I was assuming when Brian was giving his paper that almost he was leading towards the immersive experience, and it doesn't work for everything. You can't use it in every environment, but
I do really think that what you've done is very consistent with what I was talking about. And I think the idea of placing people in an environment is a very powerful technique, and surrounding them with the objects that were characteristic of that environment is obviously the way to create a context for those objects. Mm-hmm. And I think the atmospherics that you've produced in this exhibition are as close as you... Well, I haven't been to it, but from what you've been telling, what you've been telling us today, I get the feeling that this is a very evocative way of immersing people in the experience without actually the use of a TARDIS. So.
I think I should add, of course, that I'm in a privileged position that I work for a large institution that can afford to do this sort of installation too. Because to do this installation, you have to do it with some sort of historical credibility. It can't be a pastiche. There needs to... I mean, I think that what we have done is pretty historically credible. Marie Hayes is still alive. She's 88, and she came to the opening. Well, she's 89 now. She came to the opening of the exhibition. She actually cried. She said, "I'm going to go home and dream of home." And that's something, for me, that was incredibly rewarding, obviously, as a curator, to sort of think, okay, it worked at that level, that really visceral level. But I think I've been to a lot of recreations around the world, too, which haven't worked so successfully, and I think that's because they've not been done with that same insistence upon historical credibility, and that often comes down to finances, to be perfectly honest. So I'm not putting that in to say the Museum Victoria is wonderful, but it really is having that institutional support financially as well as intellectually is very important to make this work.
Andrew Willett, I'm a student at the University of Canberra doing cultural heritage studies. In the reconstruction of the houses, I take it these were based actually on document. You mentioned that they followed the floor plan of places that have been excavated. What other materials did you use or information did you use to determine the layout, colour schemes, decoration inside? And were the properties actually identified as being reconstructions?
Yeah, okay. Last point first. Yes, they're identified as recreations. There's a front panel. This was taken before it was put up. But inside of the house, outside the front of the house to the left, there's actually a panel telling you you're going into a recreation. So they are identified as being recreated spaces. Yes, we used the archaeology that gave us the floor plans. Other sort of documentation we used, there were actually drawings of houses. The Slum Reclamation Board in the early 20th century provided wonderful sort of information about the sort of types of houses, the slums that they were visiting. So they give us really detailed accounts, including things like the heights of walls, the size of the spaces, the finishes of the walls. And then we use other things like photographic evidence, other written accounts. You know, so people like Sister Esther, who were living in the streets and lanes and sort of tending to these places, would actually, not her necessarily, but were recording their visits to these sort of places. Obviously, 19th century newspaper accounts too, which you've got to take with some consideration, given the types of people that were going in and writing about the people living in these areas, because they were always presented as slum dwellers. Never did they focus upon them as being a community or family members or, you know, the people raising home, you know, having homes and raising families in them. What other information? I mean, there's a wealth of, and this is why doing archaeology, the modern city, you can actually sort of do this sort of recreation, because there's that wealth of additional archival information that you can use to support the recreation. And things like trade catalogues in terms of the windows and the doors and the door latches, painting catalogues for the types of paint that were available. Historic Houses Trust of New South Wales have done sort of fantastic research on lino, wallpaper, paint colours and so forth, so obviously drawing upon research done by other colleagues of mine.
Okay, well, there will be... Sorry? Yeah, one quick one, if we are...
I'll answer quickly. Yeah.
Ron,
sorry, go.
Ron Kerr, volunteer at the museum, so I'm speaking as a layperson. I've seen a few of these reconstructions or recreations, Jorvik and Oxford Story, or a few others. And speaking as a layperson, I think it's a much superior way to go to present history and this sort of thing to the general public. I appreciate there are restrictions, but it's when you consider objects in glass cases... can't compete. That's all I wish to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Charlotte. That was a great paper.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.